Hello, this is Bob and Cameron. Continue our series on my book, and we are entering episode number 76, and we're on page 160 of this book/pamphlet. And talking to Cameron before we started recording, he was starting to say something that I thought we should get on tape. So go ahead, Cameron. The pale face point. I don't know what part.
I'm sorry, I hesitated there because what I'm trying to do is find a post that I'm writing that has some stuff from Wyndham Lewis. Lately at the blog, I've been working on Lewis's 1929 book, Pale Face.
Yeah.
And it's quite amazing how much of that book feeds into the following decades of, or when I say following decades, I mean, McLuhan must have read it, I think, in the 30s. And then different kinds of information and problems suggested by Paleface feed into the decades of McLuhan's work from the 1940s up until the end to 1980.
Yeah, good. It's a good find because, you know, whenever I read Lewis, I'm amazed at how many ideas are lifted almost word for word by McLuhan.
Right. So, so Lewis suggests problems. He suggests areas that can be looked into and things like this. And by setting a kind of starting point for McLuhan, what he does is can illuminate where McLuhan has originality and where he doesn't. And the originality of McLuhan is really very, very limited. On the other hand, the field in which McLuhan is doing his work, like the field in which Lewis did his work, is one in which it's very, very difficult to do original stuff. And that's because the very greatest minds have worked in this field for thousands of years. Mm. And to make any original suggestion at all is very, very rare and very, very difficult.
What was the last word? Difficult?
Difficult, yes, sir.
Yeah.
So let me just read a couple things here from not from Paleface. What I'm going to do is I'm going to read a couple passages from Lemuel and Lilliput from 1944 when McLuhan was in St. Louis. He must have written this essay after he met Lewis in 43.
Oh, it was after. He'd been talking to him for about a year.
That's right. So, well, I mean, I wouldn't go that far. He had gone to Windsor and met Lewis in 1943, but he wouldn't go to Windsor himself until 1944.
Right, so but he brings Lewis down to St. Louis. And
That's right. But he's not in the same kind of contact with Lewis as he would be in 1944.
Yeah, but then that Lewis starts, you know, backing off and becoming paranoid.
Correct.
So the best time was in St. Louis. Even his buddy, Felix Giovanelli, how do you say his name?
Yeah, Giovanelli.
Yeah, he turns his apartment over to Lewis.
Yeah, I know.
And they get him painting commissions, and Lewis alienates everybody and, you know, becomes a problem. And you see in Jeffrey Meyer's book on Lewis, he interviews McLuhan about this stuff. And McLuhan is very tolerant of Lewis in what he says and how he presents his side of the story. He accepts these peculiarities of Lewis and knows to keep working with him. Like you say in one of your essays, he does not go into Pound's politics. He does not get into the political stuff of Lewis. He gets to the aesthetics or other levels of their knowledge, and he stays with that. and he kind of turns a blind eye to the peccadilloes of Lewis.
Yeah, well, his essay in, I think it was 1969,
yep,
in Atlantic, my friend Wyndham Lewis, is excellent in bringing out their interplay in St. Louis.
Yeah. And the last line is, we can now admire the carapace of his art forms.
Yep.
Important sentence there. In terms of him lifting stuff from Lewis, he lifted from Joyce and Eliot and Pound. And what McLuhan is original about is that he does a synthesis, takes the best of each one of those guys, and maybe even Yeats, and makes a synthesis without being a philosopher or creating a system. And he actually solves what they're groping towards. And this is what I keep telling the Lewis scholars in the Wyndham Lewis Society meeting I do once a month. They got to look at what McLuhan did with Lewis. He redid Lewis without all the political controversy, other than the accidental fact that he did become famous and was identified with the counterculture and kids and SDS and all that. But so he got a little trouble there. But if you're going to be like that tradition, you're going to get in trouble no matter what. But he was original in doing completing Lewis. He went further. For example, they were talking in the last meeting about the dehumanization that Lewis was talking about, that machines, you know, mechanical technologies were doing. And I point out to him, well, McLuhan went on to show that there was a superhumanization in the electric age, which Lewis might have intuited but never got to and never spelled out. So that's what's really important here, is what McLuhan did with these guys. He had the advantage of perspective and what was coming and what happened, you know, with TV in the 50s. He knew 1984 was 1934. And I've just been reading a book that proves that Big Brother locked it in 1934. And I won't go into the details, but there's your confirmation of McLuhan's chosen date. He does say somewhere else Orwell was writing about 1900. But then at other times he says 1934. So I'll go with the 34, and McLuhan was right about that year. And the deep state started in 34. And let's see, why am I saying this?
You were talking
the superhumanization.
But I think that is in Lewis. That, you know, that's the magnetic city right there.
Oh yeah, yeah, but yeah. Now he is trying. He is occasionally pointing out that everybody, the artists and all the thinkers, are missing something new that's happening. That was what the point of the Hitler book was, that there was something new here, and it could be better than bourgeois democracy. And so he gropes around dealing with that, but it's the only one has the guts to deal with it and look at it, what was happening. He was looking at the effects of new media, but he doesn't get to the easy perspective McLuhan has. I mean, McLuhan had the advantage of all those guys. He could see what he saw, and nobody else could because they weren't reading those guys or seeing through them. So he had a real easy time of it, of you know, popularizing the men of 1914 with a great original optimistic or apocalyptic or pessimistic, all mixed up. That was new. So you see Lewis is jumping around quadriphenically. I asked Paul Edwards, I said, did anybody of his generation, Lewis's time, contradict himself and hop around as much as Lewis? And he says, no, he didn't. Nobody. And I said, well, he was original there, and that the way he wrote, and people couldn't figure out what his position was, and it caused a lot of worry about him. But McLuhan refined that, could do it. I would say McLuhan did it technically. When you're in this environment, you talk that way. When you're over in this environment, you talk this way. It's not about maintaining a continuous point of view. And so he had the mistakes or the troubleshooting that Pound, every one of them, Pound, Eliot, Lewis and Joyce and Yeats, they all got into kind of trouble and got isolated. McLuhan was able to be an isolationist artist, but remain in the middle and be there in mainstream society, stirring up the pot, right? Did a pretty good.
I would agree with everything you said there, except I believe that McLuhan himself got involved in the same sort of problems that those five did and was unable to extricate himself. So,
but he had it was an easier time to be that way because if there was so much information overload and you could get, he wouldn't be so stigmatized, or if he was, everybody else was getting stigmatized. There was a lot of distractions. It wasn't a small world as it was for the 1914 guys. You see what I'm saying?
Well, I think there's some truth to that. I think it has to do with the phrase new media.
Yeah. New opportunities.
That's right. So McLuhan comes a generation or two after all of those people. He's two generations after Yeats and one generation after the 1880 guys. So he sort of comes alive in the era of new media and what...
Decentralized media. Because look... He is, in 69, the Governor General, Vanier, I think his name was trying to do something in Parliament to punish McLuhan while McLuhan was in Playboy and everywhere else, all over the place. It was more decentralized. Wyndham Lewis couldn't get anything like, he wouldn't be featured in a major magazine back then because Bloomsbury stopped it, the Bloomsbury Group. So you couldn't stop people like McLuhan and Chomsky and these people. They got their own audiences going. And they even write about that. And they became what they beheld. That there's new audiences made possible by the new media.
Yeah. But he got stopped in the opposite way, Bob. He got, instead of getting stopped by being banned, he got stopped by being broadcast.
Yeah, the Madison Avenue treatment that was done on him.
Yeah,
good point.
So... The thing that one of the few original ideas that McLuhan had was to point out to the men of 1914 that it wasn't good enough to have accurate ideas. You had to know the elementary forms behind the good ideas and behind the bad ideas.
Yeah.
And so what McLuhan did was say, okay, when we're going to look at everything, literally everything that any human being does, and by the way, this relates to where we're going in your pamphlet, because I think this is central to the idea of the anthropomorphic physical.
Yeah.
What we have to do, says McLuhan, in looking at anything, is look at the media that's involved. Well, what's the media? The media is the relation of the ear and the eye. So what McLuhan says to all these guys is, back up from your immediate ideas and instead look at the structure or the structural forms that are being presupposed in what you're doing. Now, that idea comes directly from Lewis, but Lewis doesn't look at what he calls the philosophies that are involved in the expression the expression that is human experience. Lewis says there's always a philosophy there, and that's what we have to look at. McLuhan says, yes, there's a philosophy there, but we have to look at the ratio. We can't look at the philosophy as some sort of statement or as something that could be touched or literally identified. No, there is a ratio there that we have to look at. And that ratio can be called the middle or it can be called the medium. And that is the great insight that McLuhan has, that if we want to talk about the field of human expression, we have to be able to identify its elementary form. And what is its elementary form? It's the medium. And
yeah,
he says, go ahead.
I would add that because he comes at the time of television, which completes the technological evolution in a lot of ways, He sees where it's going to. And then you go back and you read Lewis and Joyce, these guys, and they're groping for the form, but they can't see it as clear as McLuhan gets. But McLuhan is a later time where the form, the history of it, culminates with television, you know, the Tenth Thunder, and he can see it real clearly, more than they could, because he came later.
Yeah,
he had the advantage of his later evolution period in technology for that him to have that clarity. They weren't so confident of where the form was going. They didn't know. They didn't experience it. He had the advantage of experiencing where the form ended before it became satellite.
Yeah. See, for me, that's too diachronic, too chronological. Because,
well, there is chronology, for God's sake. Save the eyes.
It's not that McLuhan could see better or express himself better than Eliot, Joyce, Yeats, Pound, and Lewis. Not at all. It wasn't that he was smarter than these people.
I don't mean that. He's just luckier. He had the advantage of the later the news started to pop out all over the place. The way youth were living, the way the colonies were, it was all not the issues that Lewis is wrestling with in the 30s. Brand new. Can't deny it was a lot of new stuff, and then the computers coming in, the satellite. It really gave McLuhan the satellite vision almost. So chronological or not, it's a later phase, and he had the advantage of it. No. They didn't.
Imagine somebody talking about chemistry, and they're saying, Lavoisier or Priestley or somebody like this, they had the advantage of coming later than the alchemists who were doing some pretty good stuff in the 1700s. And that would be correct. But what is seen by the chemists is what always took place.
Right? It's always what? What they see?
What they see is what always was the case.
Okay.
Right? So you have to differentiate between the time of the insight and the time of what is seen. So the time of what is seen, that can be later in one sense, but it's if you look at what Plato and Aristotle, as an example, could already see 2,500 years ago, it's not that McLuhan had somehow better insight into human reality than they had. He just had a slightly different turn of the kaleidoscope that showed a way that maybe could communicate what Plato and Aristotle already saw. Maybe this new turn of the kaleidoscope that McLuhan made was going to be able to pass that over into everybody's vision that was impossible for 2,500 years.
What was impossible for 2,500 years?
The communication of what Plato and Aristotle could see.
So McLuhan was able to communicate it better than...
No, well, McLuhan didn't achieve communication.
Yeah, but not that. He did achieve communication. Why did everybody open their arms to him? Because he was saying something that was perfect for its time. Look, when television started happening in the 50s, culture was a whole different experience than before. And you had these crazy people like Elvis and Miles Davis, and all that stuff is going on. That's way different from the 30s. And people had to respond to a new effect, bunch of effects that was going on, and McLuhan had the advantage of that. He comes later. He experiences something Joyce and them don't experience. So that creates a new clarity, a new completion that makes him think he's getting somewheres, and he writes a comprehensive text, you know, Gutenberg, Galaxy, and Understand Media, that Apelion. And he says something that still is very important, maybe the best stuff to come out of the 20th century. Because he had the advantage of it. Now, it then gets obsolesced by the digital, but then you might apply your formula that there are principles that are universal, and you can apply the same perspective, the same approach to digital media as McLuhan did to analog completion, analog media as it was completing. So we're both right, and you know I agree with the simultaneity, and I agree with the.
I'm not trying to criticize your ideas. I think that you have amazing insight into a lot of this stuff. All we're doing is exchanging. We have different views of what McLuhan was up to and why it was, important and where it may have gone wrong. We have slightly different views on this sort of stuff. But what we're trying to do is sort of spark off our different views to come up with new stuff. And I personally think that we're doing a fairly good job at that.
And those who are listening agree with you.
Two of them?
It's very good. What'd you say, two of them?
Yeah, all two of the listeners.
Well, one of them's Carolyn. She's listening. Got her going, and she didn't watch. She didn't engage it that much before, but she finds these really useful. But the thing is, we are very close, and also... If there is a difference, it's personality or something, which
sure.
is it's just part of being an individual. But I don't see us disagreeing. I understand your view way more than I did 10, 15 years ago. You understand me way more, and
exactly.
we can use them. We don't have a problem with each other's method.
Right, right. So let me just read a couple
yeah.
of these passages from Lemuel and Lilliput.
Which is McLuhan's tribute to Lewis. He said he's going to dedicate the next 20 years of his life spreading the word on Lewis. He's a Lewisite at that point. And it's interesting you were describing in whatever I was reading today about truth and how you avoid being a fanatic. Was that in the G.K. Chesterton article, autobiography? Or in the
Could be.
Yeah, so you were pointing out his maturity about how to deal with truth. I don't know why I brought that up. Is it because of what we're about us, the difference or not? I don't know. But, he has dedicated himself to Lewis, the truth of Lewis. But it's not a fanatic truth. And he's going to be taking in stuff from Gideon and other people. But this is a major article of his appreciation of Lewis, and he does it really fast after meeting him,
Right. Well, I think he had already read some of Lewis when he was at Cambridge
in
34 to 36.
Yeah.
When he meets Lewis, then he has to read a whole bunch of him. Then generates this essay.
And they probably have interesting conversations that we don't have any record of.
Correct. Oh, absolutely. But at the same time, what he's, I don't think he becomes a pure Lewisite because he was very, very taken with Gideon. And so he had to try and read both of these guys at the same time. He had met both of them. I believe he met Gideon in May of 43, and he met Lewis in July of 43.
Yeah.
So he met them bang, and he started to read big books of both of them, and he was completely taken with both of them as ways of going beyond his thesis.
Yeah.
Right? So his thesis, which was a history of sort of the threefold of history, how the threefold of history rolls out to create history, that had been a continuation of what he had studied in Winnipeg, because his professor there had adumbrated what he called comparative philosophy, which was the threefold that always was behind philosophy. So when McLuhan talks about this in a slightly different language in his PhD thesis, he's left with the question, well, where do we go from here? What needs to be done to bring out the importance of this? And what Lewis says to him is, well, in everything that human beings do, there's always a philosophy. So the question that McLuhan then has, well, how do we recognize the philosophy? How do we recognize the type? And it will, he'll be still thinking about this 40 years later. It gives him something to think about his whole life. And what Gideon says to him is, given the plurality of first principles, how do they create music instead of noise? And that itself is a question that McLuhan will be asking for the next 40 years. So those two people that he meets in 43, only months after he finished his thesis and submitted it, give him what he needs to do with his life.
Right. What is the year that they say he got his PhD? 42 or 43?
43.
Okay. He sends it over in late 42 or something?
No, he submits the thesis in March of 43, and he's given the PhD in December of 43.
Oh, okay.
So the same year.
Yeah, and he's met Lewis, and he's met Gideon, and he's going to write this article you're going to read from within a few months after getting his PhD.
Correct.
Wow.
Correct. So his PhD leaves him with a bunch of problems. Like, for example, we're dealing with the history of the trivium here, which in a certain way is very, very, very abstract, right? It's like some sort of essence that can be distilled out of history or something. So then the question is, well, how do these abstractions relate to practical life? And one of the things that McLuhan starts to do at almost the same time is he's looking at comic books, he's looking at advertising, he's looking at popular radio programs, and television is just starting. So he's trying to look at practical, concrete things and ask, well, how does that relate to these abstractions? That's a very difficult problem, but it's one that's very fertile for him, and he's still at work on those problems 40 years later.
And that's probably the poetic enterprise. That's where he's a poet. The poet doesn't remain stuck in the abstract philosophy department. He looks around at what's happening in society.
Correct. So that's one of the ways that McLuhan tries to sort of justify him being in English rather than philosophy.
Yeah.
He says, yeah, philosophy, that's too abstract. It's too airy-fairy. Whereas, as you say, with poetics, with English, you're getting down into concrete expression. And
yep.
he likes that whole idea. And in fact, in his master's thesis, so this is from 1934, his master's thesis on Meredith, he quotes Coleridge to the effect that everybody is either a Platonist or an Aristotelian. And then McLuhan says, people are not Platonists and Aristotelians only in philosophy. They this also can be seen in literature.
Yeah.
So he's got this problem from Winnipeg that he's still working on it in Cambridge and then in St. Louis, and that is sort of the springboard for everything he's going to do for the next 40 years.
Yeah, so that's he's breaking down the separation of the disciplines. It's beginning to be interdisciplinary, what he's thinking. Is that
accurate? Sure, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, in fact, that relates to one of the things I'm going to read here very closely.
Okay.
Shall I fire away?
Yeah.
Okay, so it's a quotation from McLuhan's essay, but it has a quotation from Lewis in the middle of it. So he says, it is therefore, politically and humanly speaking, a
okay,
matter.
Okay, who says this, Lewis or McLuhan?
This is McLuhan. I'll
okay.
tell you when Lewis is
yeah.
being quoted. Okay? So I'm going to emphasize certain words in this paragraph. It is therefore, politically and humanly speaking, a matter, the word matter being very important here in my view, a matter of the utmost concern for us to know from what sources and by what means the rulers of the modern world determine what they will do next. How do they determine the ends for which, as means, they employ the vast machines of government, education, and amusement? Lewis gives, and gives is italicized in McLuhan's essay, Lewis gives the answer that, and here's the quotation from Lewis, that art and science are the very material out of which the law is made. They are the suggestion out of which are cut the beliefs by which men are governed. That's the end of the quotation from Lewis. Here's McLuhan again. That is to say, the rulers of the modern world are not detached or critical. They do not reflect. They do not consider ends. They are wholly immersed in the matter which they utilize without understanding its character. So, what is McLuhan saying here that he takes from Lewis? Lewis says that there's nothing that is done that doesn't reflect some philosophy. That's the word that Lewis uses. And the way to be critical about anything, according to Lewis, is to understand that philosophy that is embodied in what people say or do or express. Of course, because people are different, those philosophies are different. But what Lewis does not say, as far as I know, he does not say that the field of philosophies is itself a new matter of a new science. But what McLuhan is saying here in 1944 is that there is a whole new matter that we need to look at that is the subject of a new science or a new field that we need to begin to investigate inside of. And the only way to investigate a field from the inside is to identify its elements and the laws of those elements. And McLuhan does not yet know how to identify those elements. That will come in the next decade with media. And because he doesn't know how to identify the elements yet, he doesn't know how to identify their laws. But already in 1944, he knows that what Lewis is suggesting is a new kind of matter that has a new kind of law. And that's very, very interesting stuff. And that, I believe, it relates closely to your ideas about the anthropomorphic physical.
Okay, so you're saying Lewis saw there was a new matter, but what did McLuhan see clearer?
Well, what McLuhan sees is that this new matter can't be left as what Lewis calls a philosophy.
Right.
The word philosophy is too ambiguous. It's too slippery. So that when people try to understand what's going on with Lewis, they're not going to get it because his identification of what is at stake in thinking is not precise enough. And McLuhan will see that that is something that needs to be made precise, but he doesn't know how to do that, but he does know that it's a new field, a new matter.
So Lewis sees a new matter and doesn't doesn't know even if he should articulate it or something. But
no, Lewis writes this huge book or manuscript, I guess I should say, in the 1920s,
yeah,
out of which come all of his published books. And there's probably tons that are still remaining to be published out of that huge thing. So Lewis is driven in the same way that McLuhan is driven. McLuhan is writing night and day stuff in the 1940s and 1950s. He's writing night and day. He's absolutely driven, but it breaks his brain. So, you know, you have McLuhan pre-1960 and McLuhan after a post-1960.
Yeah.
And the pre-1960 is McLuhan being driven just like Lewis was being driven, and they're being driven in a similar direction, but McLuhan...
Okay, so they both see there's a new thing happening, and might even say human nature is changing, and Lewis does not, seeing the change, do what, and McLuhan does do. But you say he's too vague. It's like he doesn't have the advantage of TV, Lewis doesn't. He doesn't see the completion. McLuhan sees the TV, sees the completion, and therefore he can be more precise.
Yeah, you know, that's said in chronological terms, with which I don't agree. But I can say okay to that. But McLuhan, in directing his attention to people like Lewis and Gideon, is not directing some sort of new mind at this. He's
a new mind. Oh, a new mind.
McLuhan's mind is not any different, except that it's slightly worse than many people that went ahead of him. So he is not inventing something. He's not doing some sort of analysis that's better. He's simply shifting. It's like a kaleidoscope. He's simply shifting what's already there in a slightly different way. That's all that's happening with McLuhan. But that, when we say all that's happening, that's a huge contribution. It's not possible in this kind of realm to make any kind of difference at all. Is a huge, huge matter. But it's not something that is happening that's new at all. It's the oldest of the old.
So that he gets attention because he finds a new way to draw people to the long-range questions or the old questions, especially how the men in 1914 figured out how to talk about it came up with a new way.
But, I mean, you say he got attention. The attention that McLuhan got was not the attention that he wanted. He wanted to communicate. He wasn't able to communicate.
Well, he got attention. He started to communicate, but then outcome of that was a lot of confusion. But look at the way the world grabbed onto him. Are you going to say it's just a conspiracy by Howard Gossage and Tom Wolfe to have someone in the mid-60s and all this other turbulence in the youth culture that needs someone to explain it? Is it just that sort of practical level? But isn't there... Everybody is intrigued by what he's saying because it strikes them as new. They didn't know the background. They didn't know what the men in 1914 had done with it, but there was something new. So he either was making what they did finally get noticed, or he was very good at communicating better than they were. The 1914 guys.
I don't think either one of those happened. I think that people needed content, right? You need content for the new media.
They needed a television. Public intellectual for it.
Yeah, but, you know, that's using that in very vague terms. So McLuhan got taken up by people that wanted to use McLuhan, and he thought maybe he could use them.
Yeah.
And they were both wrong. They were both wrong.
But I think McLuhan understood why he was wrong. They were all wrong. He understood what they were up against more than anybody else.
Well, that may be, Bob, but there was no communication happening there at all, and ultimately he failed. And the kind of attention that he wanted to get is what we are trying to give him now, not what happened then.
Yeah. And it's a little late. We're coming in a little late.
Exactly. So McLuhan said all the time that his work was dedicated to the possibility of survival. So that very much is in question today. So are we able to communicate what he was trying to communicate? Are we able to say anything that has to do with the question of survival? Well, who the hell knows?
But I know. And this is not relevant to our discussion, but I know what I'm doing and why I haven't been able to talk to you for a fucking month. I am doing stuff that's incredible. And you're going to see that we are doing what McLuhan and all hope to do. We're going to do it. Which is incredible. What a claim. Somebody, finally, a human being, gets something fucking done. That's what I'm saying we're going to do. That's the big surprise coming.
Okay.
But that's not relevant. You know, that's my personal confidence. Back to the issue of McLuhan's failure or what did he succeed at. Well, he gave me a grounding for me to do successful something. So I give him credit for that. He helped.
Sure. But, Bob, I'm not saying that he was ultimately a failure. I'm saying that
within his time he was a failure.
Well, you said he got attention. And I'm saying that the attention that he got represented a failure because he was not able, through that attention, to communicate what he wanted to communicate. And I think he was well aware that that didn't work. But on the other hand, he didn't know what else to do.
Well, it worked a bit because they're still talking about him today, more than anybody else of that period.
But, Bob, I don't see why do you think that talking about somebody has any use?
I'll tell you why. Because people hear about him, they go on the Internet, and they read a couple essays. And it makes them see something they never heard of or thought of before. And those little incremental changes on individuals who think this thought probably has a synchronistic, synergistic effect. So humans are learning, even though it's not registered in the Android meme or the tech body, but they are out there learning, and they are learning from McLuhan, whatever they take from it. You know, the user is the content. But they are finding out about him, and it's going into many people's minds that never would have known about it otherwise.
And of course I agree with that, but I do. But then I ask, well, what's the effect of that? And I say that that's the sort of thing that has always gone on in human civilization, and it has eventuated in the great danger that we're now living in. So to me, just because people happen to learn something is not something that's automatically good or contributing to the light or something like that. It's something that may or may not be a disaster.
Right. We don't know. And
that's right.
If we survive it, then maybe we'll find out that McLuhan had an influence on all kinds of people in key positions of decision-making.
Mm-hmm.
Would you say there is a cynicism about media, its content, that's never happened before in the last 100 years today? A wide range is discussed with being told stuff. Which,
sure.
Everybody was told stuff for hundreds of years, and they ate it up. But now you watch humans wrestling with the fact they're forced to have these talking heads tell them shit, and they know it, and they're trying to figure out how to do something beyond that.
Absolutely. And we don't know
how that's turning out.
You could say that that is the central question at stake in the war in Ukraine and the war in Palestine right now.
Yeah.
The big question is whether or not the human civilization can be manipulated through media to maintain the way things are, or if people have developed enough cynicism about what they're being told that they're going to introduce a new era of history. We don't know the answer to that.
Yeah, and we also don't know how many people have to survive to be considered success. I mean, they could have a big war, a lot of people die, but the people that survive it are smarter. Not necessarily for it, but they're smarter because of this media cynicism. They won't let that happen, be built up again, and a new social structure will be implemented.
Yeah. See, I think that it's more like chemistry, right? I mean, we can say that, chemistry and physics and biology, all these sciences really take off in the 19th century. Now, on the one hand, the world gets completely changed through that process. On the other hand, what those sciences are talking about is what always happened, even before there was an Earth, right? So if human beings do manage to survive present history, is human being going to be that different from what it always was? No, it's going to be exactly what it always was. But can the world be fundamentally different at the same time? Yes. So that's sort of where we're at. There's this interplay between synchrony and diachrony is what human beings live. And now we've reached a kind of extreme split in those things. Synchrony has almost disappeared. So either we're going to be led off the end of the pirate's flank by diachrony, or we're going to find out how we can stop along the plank somewhere with a new synchrony.
Yeah, so that might be the difference between us is I don't think the, whatever you call these things that never change, that may change. Now, you don't think that.
Right.
I might think that it will, and I'll help implement that. So there's the difference. But I'm not a fanatic about it. If I'm going to pull it off, it's going to be done in a real lazy way. You know, behind the scenes or something. That's what I'm counting on. And so are you, because you're not trying to go to the White House to tell them what to do. You're just putting out your blog.
Yep.
Low profile. So we're similar in that way, though. Though I do have a little more public thing than you, but maybe be a lot of people reading your blog. We don't know. And that might be equal to the number of people listening to me on the radio, you know. So anyways, we're an interesting pair in this tweedledee-tweedledum situation. I won't say who's
correct.
Dumb. Tweedledee-tweedledum. Twitter. Twitter-dee-tweedledum.
Yeah. So let me just go back to this Lewis quotation.
Yeah.
As a matter of fact, I have to find out where this quotation is from because I didn't make a note of it. But McLuhan cites Lewis as saying, art and science are the very material out of which the law is made. They are the suggestion out of which are cut the beliefs by which men are governed. So when Lewis says art and science are the very material, he's not using art and science in their normal senses. He's using art and science more or less in the same way as he uses philosophy to mean something deeper than you know, some picture or some scientific law.
He's almost talking media. Almost.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So he's indicating a new field for somebody to investigate, and that person who's going to investigate it is McLuhan.
Yeah.
Right. The art are the very material. So he's not talking about material in the physical sense. He's not talking about chemical materials. He's talking about what might almost be called psychological materials, except that psychological materials aren't only psychological. They are new stuff.
Yeah, it might be formal causality that's being retrieved.
Yeah, you could say that, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that, yeah, this is a good sentence to point out in how Lewis is pointing out beyond anybody else of his time, and someone almost original has to see the value of that, and that's what McLuhan did.
Yes, and what I think with this new edition being of Lewis's work being brought out by Oxford University Press, this is an indication of how communication can take place not at all in somebody's lifetime, but 75 years later, all of a sudden, after that lifetime, after the person is dead, communication can start.
Yeah.
And I very much hope that that's what's going to go on with Lewis. But just look at the second sentence there. He said the first sentence has to do with art and science being the material. And then he says, they are the suggestion. Now,
No, what's he say? They are the suggestion?
Yeah. And it would be very easy to understand the word suggestion here as a kind of throwaway. You don't even notice that it's there. They are the suggestion. Out of them are cut the beliefs by which men are governed. But the word suggestion here goes back to Plato and Aristotle. Plato has his ideas. People think, oh, those are very, very abstract. This isn't interesting. Aristotle, Plato's great pupil, comes and says, no, that's not the way Plato was using ideas. Ideas have suggestion built into them.
Yeah.
Aristotle used the word dynamism. The ideas naturally express themselves. So you can say ideas suggest themselves. Ideas don't remain abstract. They get expressed concretely. And what we need, if we want to understand any concrete expression, we have to replay that concrete expression back to its origin, back to its original suggestion. So
read that sentence again now in light of what you've said.
Okay. Lewis gives the answer that quote, art and science are the very material out of which, look at the word out of which the law is made. They are the suggestion, semicolon. Out of them are cut the beliefs by which men are governed. Now, this all goes back to Plato and Aristotle. And Plato and Aristotle themselves went back. But what's being said here is that art and science are the very material. That is to say, the material of the new science, or the new field that needs to be analyzed and through analysis be given birth, the new material is something like art and science. That is to say, it's not the physical stuff of the world that chemistry looks at. It's like an art or like a science, and that is the matter that we have to look at. But that matter, or those ideas, you could say, are something that goes out of itself. It is a suggestion. That is to say, it doesn't remain abstract. It gets expressed. It is made concrete. So that's already in Lewis, and Lewis understands that from time immemorial.
Okay, so then the second sentence says,
they are the suggestion. Right? They are the original idea that has externality built into it.
Yeah, but read the whole second sentence after the art and science sentence.
Okay, so the sentence is they, that is to say the art and science that are the material, they are the suggestion, semicolon. Out of them are cut the beliefs by which men are governed.
And okay, what's the sentence after that then?
Oh, after that comes McLuhan.
And that's it.
That's it.
Okay. So there's your determinism, technological determinism. He's really talking about art and science as there's a medium underlying them.
Yeah, but I don't know how you... To me, that's not determinism at all, because men are different, women are different, all
individuals...
But he uses
the word determined.
Where?
Isn't at the very end, at the what you read at the very end.
Yeah, but okay. He says here, they are the suggestion, semicolon. Out of them are cut the beliefs by which men are governed. Okay,
so governed, not determined.
Mean?
Governed,
right? But what does governed mean? Governed means he's first of all he's thinking about the rulers of the world. Governing people through laws, through entertainment, through newspapers, and all that sort of stuff. But the word are governed also suggests that people are passive in relation to these possible arts and sciences, that the arts and the sciences are more primitive than people are. So people are governed by them. So you could say that they are determined by them. But the thing is, they're not singular. There's arts and there's sciences and there's philosophies. And the whole panoply of human history is generated by the play of these forces, just like the physical world is generated by the play of chemical elements. So it's not that men are governed in a determined way, so as if they were puppets or something like this, that these arts and sciences can control. Instead, they're governed by something that is plural in the soul or unconsciousness of human beings. And in that plurality is human freedom. So it's humans are being governed, but in a way that isn't determinism in the normal sense of determinism.
Right. So now, do you know where this is from? When did he say this?
Lewis?
Yeah.
No, but I'm going to look it up this minute.
Okay.
It's something that I've been...
trying to do.
Yeah, in the course of writing this post, I bring out all sorts of other statements about matter and material in the Lewis essay from 1944, and I try to show that the McLuhan is already very clear that there's a new kind of matter here, that human beings need to understand what this matter is if they're going to release themselves from its capture, and that when he comes in 1946 to talk about the maelstrom and how it's possible to release from the maelstrom, he's thinking about the maelstrom in terms of this new matter.
So where are you looking for it? Where do you think it is?
Oh, I don't know, but I'll look it up in Google Books and see what that says. But I have to find I've got so many different windows open here on my computer that I have to find one that I can void.
Yeah. We can wait.
Yeah, well, we're coming up here. It's from The Art of Being Ruled, page 111.
Yeah, that's what I kept thinking, The Art of Being Ruled. That's what he was saying in that sentence, by which we were governed. Page 111. Okay, good. So that is all his thinking. You know, a man of the world, you know, 1,500 pages he was writing, 23, 24, 25, and then, you know, five or six, seven books come out of that. From 26 to 30.
So you asked me, what does Lewis say after that?
Yeah.
Okay, so he says here, like a mammal growing wings, he exists thenceforth in another and freer element. Can you believe that? Here is Lewis saying, in The Art of Being Ruled, in 1926, he's defining what it is that McLuhan has to think.
Yeah.
And McLuhan never succeeds in doing that. But he comes close. So in another and freer element. But this free region is not conterminous with the arts and sciences.
Wait, that's what you're saying.
Well, wait a sec.
So he's talking about the mammal. It makes a new extension, wings.
Yeah, that's right. And according to my reading of both Lewis and McLuhan, it's not that the mammal grows new wings. It's the kind of mammal that he wants to talk about always had the wings, but they weren't thematized. Chemistry was always what was going on with the whole universe. But it wasn't thematized.
Mm.
So chemistry was new, but what chemistry was talking about was the oldest of the old. And I believe the same thing is going on with Lewis and McLuhan. So he says, let me read this, the passage. Like a mammal growing wings, he exists thenceforth in another and freer element.
But what is thenceforth? Well, I didn't get the noun.
What's that?
What stands forth? What
he
was the word?
I'm not sure what you're saying.
Okay, do it again. The mammal and the wings. Start there.
Like the mammal growing wings, he exists.
The exist, what's that?
Exists.
Not existence. They exist, T-H-E-Y?
No, he. Like a mammal growing wings, he exists. Hence, thenceforth, in another and freer element.
It's H-E, he exists?
Yeah.
Okay.
Bob,
don't worry about
if
it.
It's
the phone. You know, I'm just not getting what the syllable is. He exists.
Right. But you would, maybe you're the person that should be reading this. I'll send you the phrase in an email, and you plug that into advanced search in Google Books, and it will bring up page 111 of The Art of Being Ruled.
We do that right now.
Yeah.
Okay.
You're a better reader than I am. You are a person that's used to being on the radio and having to enunciate for people to understand what the hell they're talking about,
yeah.
Or you're talking about.
Okay, I'm waiting for the email.
I'm waiting for my I'm sending it to Purple.
Yeah.
Uh, And what I should do here is I should look at, I'll also send you, do you know how to go to Advanced Book Search?
To what?
To Advanced Book Search. Do I really, am I really such a bad enunciator? I can't believe it.
Well, you're a bit low, and I my phone is not digital. It's not perfect.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Don't worry about it. We'll get over it.
But you know what I did? I think I... I can't believe it. I screwed up the the letter that I was sending you. I screwed up. I have to open up the...
Okay, let's just read it. I can make it out. He exists. Okay, let's carry on. You know, it was good that you got me to look at my email. I had an email. I had to fucking answer. I didn't see it there. So while I was waiting, I got to answer this. So thanks for drawing my attention to the email. That was the real reason. So go back. He exists, the mammal, growing wings.
Right. So
he exists. Stop looking for it. Forget it.
What I'm going to do is I've been going back to the start of the paragraph. So what I'm going to do is read the whole paragraph, and you can let me know when I'm not being clear.
Yeah.
Because I think this is a very, very important paragraph.
Yeah.
So this is from Lewis, Art of Being Ruled, page 111. In a very small percentage of cases, better brains and good social opportunities enable a person to extricate himself from this ideologic machine. So you could say that what Lewis and McLuhan are both concerned about is extrication from the ideologic machine, and especially how that relates to survival.
Yeah.
So, extricate himself from this ideologic machine. Like a mammal growing wings, he exists thenceforth in another and freer element.
But there's your decentralization.
What's that?
There's your decentralization, the freer element.
I don't know that I would call it decentralization. Why do you call it that?
Because the bonds of community are diminishing. And though people are more alone or even lonely, they are given access in their tribe to do things that no one else knows they're doing. Everybody was always under surveillance by the community. Now they're flying fly by the nets, you know, that Joyce phrase that McLuhan emphasized. You fly by the nets. You pass
okay,
them. You're freer. The wings give you a freer mobility. And, of course, all kinds of mafias and secret stuff can spring up, but all kinds of new formations of people, the way they live their lives, they're not as controlled by the church or whatever, different things. That's the new, I'm calling that decentralization from,
yeah,
Big Brother.
Yeah, I really don't recognize the word, but... The thought is one that I just completely disagree with. It's one that is central to whatever differences we have.
Right,
because,
but he did say that, he's saying it's freer.
Yeah, but he's talking about a small percentage of cases, and you're talking about some sort of historical development. It couldn't be any more different.
He says only a few people are getting the wings?
Yes. He says in a very small percentage of cases, better brains and good social opportunities enable a person to extricate himself from the ideologic machine. So what you were talking about with decontextualization or something, that
decentralization.
Decentralization. What you are calling decentralization, I think, is what Lewis and McLuhan call the ideologic machine. It's what traps people, not what sets them free.
Well, yeah, there is it's a medium. And decentralization means that smarter people can begin to move into areas that aren't covered, aren't within the centralized perspective or panopticon. So that is what the men of 1914 in their art, they are doing that. They're moving into a freer zone. They're the beginning people of the new culture. And Lewis even says that about himself in Blast. You know, we are the something of the new civilization. He has that sentence. So it starts off with a minority. But look, it's gone. McLuhan caught the crest of that minority getting bigger, you know, 30 years later. And then I'm here where it's even huge.
You see, I think it's smaller.
It doesn't matter.
Let me read the paragraph, but we'll just agree to disagree on that.
Yeah, it's not that important. You know something's afoot. I know something's afoot, and maybe what we're measuring is not the same or the consequences. But something's afoot, and it's Lewis then picked up on it. Then McLuhan picked up on it and made a better expression of it. And then we're here.
Yeah.
Our turn.
Right. So the person he's talking about is the very small percentage of cases who frees himself from the ideologic machine.
Yeah, and, which is the medium, Lewis, right? The ideologic machine is the medium.
No, it's the ignorance of the medium. There's nothing about the medium that is ideologic. It's the particular use of the medium.
Okay.
So he's talking about the person who's able to free himself or herself from the ideologic machine. Like a mammal growing wings, he exists thenceforth in another and freer element. But this free region is not conterminous with the arts and sciences.
Not determinous or coterminous? What'd you say there?
Conterminous is the word he uses.
It's so not conterminous.
You know, Lewis uses a lot of words that aren't really words. You know that.
Yeah. So what's he say there? Read that last bit.
But this free region is not conterminous with the arts and sciences. And don't comment on that until we get down a little bit later.
Okay.
Okay? And free, semicolon, and free spirits do not, as is popularly supposed, inhabit the bodies of men of science or artists. For art and science are the very material out of which the law is made. They are the suggestion. Out of them are cut the beliefs by which men are governed, and the teacher is usually as much a dupe as the learner.
Ooh.
End of paragraph.
So, that's a good one.
Yeah. So what he's saying, when he says the art and science are the very material, he's saying that they are what needs to be analyzed. They are not what does the analysis.
Yes.
And he's saying
he's correct.
That,
and
yes,
these smarter brains with new social opportunities are not the cliche free spirits. They're the abstracted ones. The visual space dupes are the free spirits. There's a new kind of freedom, which includes being ruled, the art of being ruled. The free spirits, they're not going to fucking think they're ruled. They're going to do everything to express their independence. And he's always, I just finished Apes of God. He's satirizing all these people who think they're free spirits.
Yeah. And free spirits is a reference to Nietzsche. Nietzsche often used phrases like that.
What did he mean by them? What were his free spirits?
Yeah, well, Nietzsche would second what you're saying, and so would McLuhan, of course. But the term like free spirits always has at least two very different meanings. Lewis is talking here about a mammal growing wings. And that possibility is the possibility of somebody being a free spirit.
Yeah.
But usually what we mean by free spirit is somebody who's not a free spirit at all.
Yeah.
So as what you're doing is you're bringing out the inherent complexity of a term like this, which and that complexity is what makes communication so difficult. And the it's the difficulty of communication that calls forth the need for precision. How are we going to make this matter, this material that Lewis is talking about, precise enough that we can begin doing collective investigation of it, and through that collective investigation, can we perhaps make the world a different place in which survival is no longer the threat to survival is no longer over us.
I had something to say there. Oh, yeah, you may be making too much out of the difficulty of communication.
Of course it's possible.
There may be a lot of communication happening, and maybe people don't know what to do with such colossal meaning being made obvious. Too much meaning. Too much understanding. So bouncing off your... You're always commenting on the difficulty of communication. So I think we need to bounce off saying, well, that might be a mind game you got yourself into, a conundrum. It may not be about whether it's communicable or not.
Yeah, well, remember that a very smart guy by the name of Bob Dobbs has often made much of the idea that any communication at all is a miracle.
That's right. That's right. That's going to be on my fake grave. Because I ain't dying. So, yes. Well, what is it? It's the miracle. Communication is a miracle, but not impossible. Then Barry Nevitt adds a word. He says communication of the new is a miracle, but not impossible. I think that's what Barry adds. I think the original doesn't have new in it.
That's probably the sort of thing that got Marshall very frustrated with Barry. You probably know the interview with Corinne where she gets asked something like, what was Marshall's favorite book? And she says, well, I don't know what his favorite book is, but I know the book he liked the least, and that was Take Today. And she says something like... He and Barry turned out something there that Marshall was very unhappy with.
Well, that would be in 72, 73. As Marshall or somebody says, I don't know what they're citing, but they say later he had a newer appreciation of it. That was the last commentary on the book about McLuhan that someone says. Maybe you missed that night. That Monday night seminar where that was said. Mrs. McLuhan may have missed that. Yes, he had a problem in 72, and Mark Stewart always joked about when they went on David Frost, the two of them, and Barry was like a talking maniac, you know. Like, he'd never been on before, so he couldn't shut up. And so he made a fool of himself in a way. And probably Corinne saw that, and Marshall had to agree with Corinne. She had the Swami there. They had to do their yoga. And, you know, difficult times for McLuhan there. He's half healthy. And it wasn't until 77, 78 he appreciated Take Today because other people started to read it and appreciate it. Among McLuhanites that read his stuff that I know of really value that book. Do you value it? Do you like it?
Yes. I think it's a bit of a hodgepodge. I think there's things in Take Today that are very misleading. But on the other hand, it's a little bit like a blind person tapping around with their cane. McLuhan was trying to communicate something and using Barry to help in that process. And whenever he used a co-writer like that, there were always advantages and disadvantages.
Yeah.
McLuhan, I think he may have felt that they were close to some really important stuff and they didn't get there.
Well, I've been finding some quotes lately in posting from Take Today, and I've got the book sitting over there. I'm going to go back and try to find some more quotes. Other people are putting out more traditional McLuhan quotes, and the new ones people are responding to because they never noticed them. They didn't read Take Today, and it's a new slant on things, clarifying what was the message. You know, it's aspects that didn't get said in the earlier books. So I'm into Take Today right now, highlighting the good stuff. That's what I'm doing.
Yeah. Well, good. I mean, I remember you saying good, interesting stuff about Take Today 25 years ago.
Yeah, yeah.
So,
well, it's always been my favorite book, almost my favorite. But I go back to the other stuff, and they're all great, too. But there's so much in Take Today that no one notices. It's just a lot of pages, a lot of information that most people don't have the patience to wade through.
Yeah.
So I've been wading through it for, many, many decades.
Right.
More than other people, I think. Nobody quotes it as much as I do, I think.
Yeah. That's a side of your work that I don't understand. I have no idea how you have the patience or even the desire you do that huge amount of stuff with people that, in my view, have no idea what they're talking about.
You're talking about the content that Barry highlights. Don't know.
No, I'm talking about your activities with other quote.
Oh yeah, the ne'er do wells, the fucking lazy ones.
Well, like
Jesus, I go to the pub. I hang out with the lowlife. I'm very tolerant for that for some reason. I find meaning in what they do. I'm always catching them. I'm always pointing out, okay, well, you just illustrated this. And then I tell them what they illustrated by what they had said or done, and they usually don't understand what I got out of it, but it makes them think for a minute, oh, geez, I did something to Bob, got great meaning out of it, I don't know what it is.
Sure.
Yeah, so
there's nothing that's not material for analysis.
That's right. I'm an exemplary of that. Yeah, people have commented on who I talk to. I am not a snob.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I don't object to that whatsoever. That's like what we were saying earlier when we were talking about going to a region like Pictou, Nova Scotia, for example, and talking to anybody that's there and getting information through that. My objection or my observation doesn't have to do with talking to anybody. It has to do with the percentage of time that you spend doing that as opposed to other possible things.
Yeah. Well, I do in many ways have more time than people have.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, if a person doesn't need to sleep, they're multiplying their time, right?
Okay, so let's go into the page 160.
Yeah, but maybe as a start to that, I mean, do you find, as I do, that the stuff we're talking about from Lewis and McLuhan's relationship with Lewis, that relates closely, in my view, to what you're talking about with the anthropomorphic physical. Do you agree with that? Or
I'm not sure.
Okay.
I was thinking, it came to me the other day that the anthropomorphic physical, what I'm referring to, is not the user is the content, but the used is the content. And we'll see how that goes. But, McLuhan in Take Today talks about the flip into, that's the first quote I have here. It is man who has become both figure and ground via the electrotechnical extension of his awareness, page 11 right. in Take Today.
Correct.
And I always thought that was an important quote, and it probably is what I'm trying to get at with the anthropomorphic physical. And then I always cite the Playboy,
right.
where he says the content is the new ground, and he has content italicized. So something had come together in the late 60s so that the understanding media phase in 64 of form and content, they go through a phase where form and content merge. And then he says a few years later, man is both figure and ground. So if you've been reading McLuhan separately, seriously, and learning about the difference between form and content, then you come to, or figure and ground, then you come to this statement, it's going to throw you, I think. You say, well, how could that be? How does man become figure and ground? How does form and content come together? Well, when you write a book, you highlight opposites. It's diachronic. It splits things up. It makes it too clear. So you got to look at Finnegan's Wake, which merges words and syllables so that you can't even get a clear word, let alone two clear words. So in that situation, people project what they think or hope makes them human or special or something that's not glued to the environment. So to put human characteristics in animals is to establish your domain over nature. Nature is not something against me, I can control it by saying it's just like humans. So that desire is where we get, once we've canceled out everything, the satellites extended the planet, and then the effect of that is a hologram, and then you have the increasing implosion of digital media, so the hologram gets tinier and tinier, and you're going to get into the homeopathic. And in that, everybody's looking for a memory of the human. And that is a major concern today. People are saying, beginning with Catherine Hale's book, How We Became Post-Human, over the last 20 years in academia, they're wrestling with what is still a residue of the human. So that desire to project and find the human or find it, maybe I would say each of the bodies has a different aspect of human in it, and that is now the ground. The ground is not technology, it is the search of consciousness, of whatever humans think they are when they're conscious. So let's see if that's what I'm trying to say. So the use is the content. You could say the user is the content has taken over. Now, Frank Zangroni says this in Media Simplex in 2001. He says the content is now ruling the form. So I see it all over the place. What I'm thinking the AP is, I see lots of groping for that. It could be considered after McLuhan, post-McLuhan. There needs to be another kind of questioning. And it seems to be about what is left of the user. So that's my introductory explanation.
Let me say that I don't agree with any of that. I think that these questions are pre-McLuhan, not post-McLuhan, and that they're already said in stark terms by Lewis.
So okay, let's see
when
that.
When he says art and science, he's talking about the human being as both figure and ground, or man becomes both figure and ground. When Lewis talks about people being governed by philosophy, that itself is philosophy, you could say. So there's figure and ground is the matter and the form of what needs to be thought.
Yeah, I go with these words. Remember, the anthropomorphic physical on the tiny note chart is the whole chart. 1960 to 1990 is the Dobbs quadrant. And the other quadrants are subsets or phases through that 30-year process or that span of time. So the anthropomorphic physical, this chart is saying, is the new ground. So let's see if I get anywhere near saying that.
Uh-huh.
So page 160 at the top, part 5 of 6 parts. The anthropomorphic physical, in brackets AP. So when I put AP, I'm referring to anthropomorphic physical, not anthropomorphic physical. So I say, look at the first quotation below. Man becomes both figure and ground, another merger of medium and message. Because I had talked about that was like the fifth or sixth definition of the medium as a message, right? McLuhan said to the father, to the priest, that he didn't know the difference anymore.
Yeah.
Yeah, so there's the merging coming. Now, he may have always worked from the merger since the 40s and recognized it in Lewis, but when you write books, you're going to separate things. So you create a diachronic problem. And then you're going to spend a lot of work trying to cancel it. And so that's what Joyce did with Finnegan's Wake. So he's going to redo Finnegan's Wake. It starts off with by making the fallacy. Remember, he says, you think my fallacy is wrong. Well, it's not wrong if it was a useful beginning. So that leads me to agree that Lewis did it. Okay, so then you have the quote from Marshall McLuhan and Barry Nevitt. It is man who has become both figure and ground via the electrotechnical extension of his awareness. That's crude awareness. Raw awareness is what people are trying to figure out what of that remains, right? This is not part person or concept. This is awareness. And McLuhan once said, I think, that original sin was lack of awareness. You remember that quote?
No.
He says that somewhere. He talks about original sin as lack of awareness. Okay, well, I'll see if I can find that at some point. So I say once that background is acknowledged, figure and ground have merged, I suggest the application of my five-bodied model implies the following phrases. Then I have myself saying these titles fit what I'm trying to say. Now, what titles am I talking about? Okay, so I've got different articles. Okay, so so I suggest the application of my five-body model implies the following phases. That might be too diachronic for you. So the following titles fit what I'm trying to say, not the details of their article. So I'm isolating the titles. First
yeah,
one.
Yeah, so I think you mean the titles that are going to follow.
Yes. No, I see them. I number them.
Yeah.
One.
But one thing I want to just bring out here, you use the word merger, and I'm not so sure that that's a good word to use. Man becomes both figure and ground. That's not intended, at least in my reading, as a merger.
No, yeah. The better word is tactile. If you understand tactile is the on and
absolutely.
Off.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's a conversational statement, merger. I'm more lazy and relaxed in what I say in the blue parts. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's bar talk. I'm talking to some guy in the bar who doesn't know merger is not a good word. And then I pose the pink quotes. It's more precise with that phrase, the electrotechnical extension of his awareness. So once you get what I'm saying about that, content becomes ground. And, yes, there's a tactile flipping back and forth, I like to say, even though that might not be the right image, flipping back and forth. But that's the way people hear it. Once that background is acknowledged, I suggest the application of my five-body model implies the following phases. Have I laid out the five bodies already?
Yes. We went through your
they're done.
Your chart.
All right. So
But, of course, we can go back there at some point.
No. Yeah, so we got the five bodies. I already said it. Here are the titles. The Media Fit, The Battle of Jericho. That's July 1956, Explorations Magazine number 6. Republished in pamphlet number 16 in 2005 in the Ginkgo Press collection, Marshall McLuhan Unbound, where they take 20 important McLuhan articles. So Media Fit, The Battle of Jericho. That's where the walls get knocked down. So all the walls are disappearing. That's the kind of fusion. So I say the walls are knocked down for the chemical body and astral body via analog media. That's the 20th century before you get to the digital, which is late.
And we should point out that the knocking down of walls is an image that McLuhan took from the Andre
Malraux.
Yeah. He used it for classroom without walls, pornography without walls, brothel without walls, on and on and on, right? So it was one of his favorite images.
Yeah, and that's in the Croker quadrant, you have number 14. The one of 1-4 represents the no walls. The four is the necessary anthropomorphic physical of propping up walls, fake as they could be or fragile, to create a bit of difference to the implosion. So 14, four is, you know, quadrophenia. It's hysteria, panic, ecstasy, schizophrenia. I got five conditions in the tiny note chart.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that's these fraudulent selves or walls that people have been propping up the last 40 years, which you object to, the AP. These are grasping at attempts to duck. You don't get the whole of your head blown off. Okay? So this is the attack on people, on their awareness. So the walls are knocked down for the chemical body and astral body, which at that time, 30 years ago, I was saying was original, first nature. Not second nature, which is the technologies. Now, what? Did you say something?
No.
Just another voice came in. The TV body and chip body are made by humans. They're not given by first nature. I might not agree with that anymore, having talked to Ion, but that's not in this article.
But when you say made, that's an interesting distinction from merge, right? So I think made is the right term then.
Yeah, that they were made by first nature, you mean?
Well, I'm just saying that the distinction between merging and making is at the very heart of McLuhan's work.
Okay.
For the reason that figure and ground can merge without becoming sort of obviated is that the
complementary making process is involved.
Correct. Correct. So that a figure can be an appropriate representation of ground.
Yeah, and that could be what I'm getting at with AP.
Uh-huh. I think it is. So you have the big question that's being raised is if something is inherently plural, can it still come to some sort of resolution, some sort of focus?
Yeah.
And the answer to that is yes, it can, because focus is a matter of making, not of merging.
Yeah. Yeah, merging can have an aspect of matching in it.
Correct. Yeah, the urge to merge is the urge to match.
Right. Okay, so then I have the quote from page 21 in Finney's Wake. Why do I am a look like a posse of Porter Peas? That is replayed in Finney's Wake all through the book. It's originally said in the prank queen section, I think, where the woman knocks on the king's door and intrudes. She's known as the prank queen. And when in my copy of The Skeleton Key of Finnegan's Wake, which is McLuhan's copy, and I have it, there's not many annotations by McLuhan, this book by Campbell and Robinson, but he does say at the beginning that Campbell does not know, understand what the prank queen is. And the prank queen is the effect of the alphabet, the beginning of visual space. And so this merger or fusion, why do I look like a posse of Porter Peas, is a major effect or theme in Finney's Wake. So I say, Humphrey Chimpton Earwicker, HCE, pronounces variations in different languages of the sentence above, meaning the posse of Porter Peas, all the way through Finney's Wake. He's trying to figure out, quote, why have I changed? Why do I look like this now, unquote. He doesn't know the media changed him, or he's asking rhetorically because he does know, to see if you know. The walls have been knocked down, but then they're rebuilt by the digital technology. So when I bring in cosmic awareness, and it said that the original separateness merged with the plane of essence in 67, and you then have the, and that original separateness was called Rai. Now, this is another esoteric source. Remember, McLuhan says, a lot of my sources are esoteric. Well, this is very esoteric. And so the after image that's left is the Internet and string theory and the answer, the AP. All these things are what the digital we didn't need to do the digital, but we did because we were incomplete. So we wanted to put some walls up, and that's the very transparent digital walls. They're rebuilt by the digital technology, and that is another aspect of the urge for the AP. So then the second title, I say is symptomatic of this, is what we just quoted, December 68 Playboy magazine, The Reversal of the Overheated Image. Well, the subtitle is Mind Your Meteor Men or You'll Catch a Cold Environment. And we caught a cold environment after 69. All right?
Yep.
And it became acoustically defined as string theory or a reference to acoustic effects. And what else? And the Internet, which is an interesting imploded environment where a lot of making goes on of no consequence. They even have an economy based on it, and it's adding up the number of people who bought a fucking chocolate bar. Talk about superfluity of information, yet it becomes a ground or a pseudo-ground. So this is the nebulous area. This is where it's, quote, post-McLuhan, post his time, post-media. That's what I'm groping with here, right? We are somewheres, but it's very hard to say how it is, and that's been the problem with 34 years. People haven't. I've seen people say, "Yeah, McLuhan was right on for his time, but this is a new, different time. We need a new McLuhan." You ever see that plea?
Yeah. It's ridiculous, but that I see
yeah,
it all
but
the
it's,
time.
It's communicating something that we got somewheres that McLuhan is relevant to, but we don't understand McLuhan, or we don't understand the continuity of him. We think that he's just talking about TV, and it's ingrown. He complained that he couldn't talk about TV with his students in the 90s. They didn't have a TV. They didn't know what the fucking word referred to. So that's why he came up with the phrase simplex. The digital added complexity, even though it made things easier and simpler. That's his thesis. That's part of the figure ground merger making an AP reality. So after I say that, I go, mind your media men. These are the intelligence agency personnel. These are the people that make the patterns that dominate and rule society. They're being ruled by icon now, by slogan. by what the White House says.
Mm-hmm.
And remember,
but notice what Bob is saying here is exactly what Lewis said in 1926.
When I'm reading Lewis, I feel that way. Yes.
Uh-huh.
No, I'm really struck by what he did, what he said.
Yeah.
He really got it. And it's interesting how nobody, they projected on him that he was paranoid, that he was schizophrenic and hysterical. They were that. Bloomsbury projected that, and they were the ones.
Lewis was not understood, but people knew unconsciously that what he was saying was disturbing.
Yeah.
And so then what they did was they took the disturbance and put it onto other stuff like politics or race or
Hitler.
Whatever. Yeah, so it was Lewis for at least 100 years has been seen only through a glass darkly. He's been seen through distortion. That may be coming to an end now. We'll see.
Yeah, now this is Paul and Alan, the two baby boomers or just born before baby boomer time, early 40s, say, they led the Lewis, quote, revival, or tried to, and they're both in the society. So I'm doing anthropology on the Wyndham Lewis gang. What are they going to do with this change that you just stated? And they have said, Joyce dominated in the 20th century. We're going to make Lewis be the figure of awe and wonder in the 21st century. I think that's going to be pretty hard to do, but they have the motive. They see that Lewis in some way is more relevant than looking at Joyce. And remember, Lewis said that about Joyce, that his Ulysses is old-fashioned. What old Dublin? Who gives a damn about that? What about where we're dealing with radio? We're dealing with newspapers and movies, come on, you know, in the 20s. And he was picking up on what was the real issues, not nostalgia for old Dublin. So that part of Lewis is what stands. And McLuhan replayed Lewis exactly. He had the same problem, if you want to say he had a problem. He did but Lewis again. And
if you,
go ahead.
If you read Paleface, today,
yeah,
in the age of wokedom, it's like somebody set out in 1929, and actually it was written in 27. Somebody came from England to the United States, and for the first time, and looked at United States, and then wrote Paleface. And what did they write? They wrote that the world has become a moral place. That's what Lewis says. Everything has been taken over by morality.
Yeah.
And that's where we are today. 100 years later, all the world has done is made concrete what Lewis could already see in the abstract.
Yeah, and that's where Croker and them, in their journal, put together a book about value, the valuation of values as the new trend in the 80s. I think that's what he meant by morals. His buddy, John Fichetti, the student of Thiel, who taught at Trent, he gets into the moral stuff of the 90s. But they also called it values, which is content. But McLuhan predicted that content would become ground. So the arguing over values and morals is the after image of the human.
Sure. So that's, I mean, but that's all that happens these days, right?
Yeah.
That's what politics is about, what education is about, what art is about. I mean, it's all nonsense.
And we read Lewis books. We reread them in this group. And they're always, when we start talking about them, once a month, whatever we've read, everybody says, it's amazing. The guy is right up there with today. This stuff is relevant today, you know?
Correct.
They're struck by that. You can't miss it. He's talking like someone about today, in today, but from a detachment that is ahead of everybody. on the issues. Yep. Yeah, that's what's interesting about. So, like, he put into English what Joyce didn't know how to put into English. He could only paint it. He did the pictorial, tactile presentation of the dilemma, and Lewis knew how to talk about it in English. So he didn't have to, you know, jump through multilingual, multi-punning hoops, though he recognizes that's the issue that Joyce is pointing to. So, and maybe Dobbs is doing this. So the walls are then rebuilt for the TV body, but not for the chemical body. And the astral body is rebuilt via the chip body, which is the 21st century. So then I say, citing the cold, so-called violent late 60s, the Westerners sometimes like to say it was more violent back then than now. People in the West, I guess I mean. It was violent because people wanted to be able to experience it from the safety of their home. They didn't walk out there among the non-walls. So, citing the cold, so-called violent late 60s, it was more violent, they thought, back then. And they didn't know it would get even more violent because people stayed in their home and watched it on TV. They didn't want to walk among the global theater, the global membrane. They didn't want to walk out there among the non-walls. So then I quote James Joyce, chalking ogres on walls, projecting ogres, humans, into the post-human, into the environment, which is being projected as anthropomorphic physical or being seen that way. So then I say, in Understanding Media, there's a page where McLuhan talks about the photograph is the brothel without walls. He uses the phrase without walls many times. Different parts of the... Go ahead.
No, that's what I was talking about a little while ago, and here you are saying exactly the same thing.
Yeah, Malraux. He uses the phrase without walls many times. Different parts of the media are without walls. It's the end of the fragmented, isolated, private self. That's what my gossipy in the bar says. That's what we're going to call the blue part. That's Bob hanging out in the bar.
All right.
Talking among the peasants who don't deserve to hear my talk, but I'm doing it. I'm saying that McLuhan, whatever he said, has no anti-environmental impact anymore. The digital phase of the Android meme aping us, that's 1980 to 2000, when he died in 1980, popularized by Twin Peaks, the Return series in 2019. So the digital phase of the Android meme aping us is a flip from the analog phase of the Android meme shaping us. So we're not being shaped anymore. We're up against the aping or us projecting that something out there is aping us. We're looking for the something to connect with. So the shaping is a 60 to 80, popularized by the Matrix series. But then the aping is Twin Peaks. So the tools weren't shaping us anymore, perhaps popularized by 2001 A Space Odyssey from Stanley Kubrick. What is that? I'm saying the medium is the message is popularized? I mean, he did think he was doing McLuhan, but in the Playboy interview he does around that time, he says he actually did the opposite of McLuhan. But McLuhan was on his mind in making that movie. He even wanted McLuhan to see it, force him to watch it. So they say that man, okay, so here we get into what's being extended, not us. Now, the damn fucking mammal, if the machines are mammals or mammalian, they are extending themselves. So I'm saying the Android meme is extending itself. Its different parts are not extensions of human faculties. We're witnessing this thing, this mammal growing wings, extending itself. It's not influencing human beings other than they have a general depression because it's the end of technology and they're taking that as the end of World War III. The shaping us is in the Matrix series. The tools weren't shaping or massaging humans anymore. That's what's funny. The Android meme replays McLuhan, creates a McLuhan revival. Well, what McLuhan says is not applicable anymore if you listen to me. Well, McLuhan said it 50 years ago. You can't tell what's the medium and what's the message. The Android meme is aping us. Now, this is a line in the album, the medium is a massage, where somebody says the media are shaping us, and then later it's said, no, they're aping us. Now, actually, I heard the album the other day, and I realized the apingness is said first. Then the shaping sentence is later in the album. I had remembered it backwards all these years. So anyways, that was a new shocker. The Android meme is aping us with more Jerry Springer-type shows, and the audiences think that the world is getting dumber and dumber. No, the Android meme is getting smarter and showing how humans can believe they are still humans. There's allowing the AP to appear to be viable. This is all a fighting against the fact that everything has disappeared. Every now and then, somebody from way back then will show to me, hey, Bob, everything's disappeared. You know, I used to say that in CKLN 40 years ago.
Yep.
They remember. It comes rushing back to them 30 years later. That's my slogan. You know, that's what I'm identified with. That's my medium is a message. Hey, Marshall, medium is a message. Well, they say, hey, Bob, everything's disappeared. So shaping is the media massaging you and doing something to you. But the media aren't doing anything to you now. Most people would believe knowledge is doing something to us. They take the conventional literate view, but they don't notice that you can't figure out what it is. Who's doing it? Plus, nobody can stop it. You can't find the faucet to turn it off. And then the sober Bob says, I'm now back on in the classroom, and I know this is a difficult percept to get. Then, it's not blue, but, oh, no, this is a quote. Okay. So then there's this long quote from Croker. Where does it end?
164.
Oh, a long, real long quote. It's interrupted. Holy shit.
Yeah.
So that's from his great book, Spasm, in 1993, subtitled Virtual Reality, Android Music, and Electric Flesh. So he's starting to use the word Android in that period, around the time I'm starting to use it. So let's go back to this quote. It's a good one. And it is attempting to complexify what McLuhan simplified. So Coker writes, maybe we are already living in another dimension of space travel, in a subspace warp jump, a virtual reality where we can finally recognize that we are destined to leave this planet because we have already exited this body. Not simply the violent expulsion of the body from the weight of earthly gravity into galactic space, but the development of microscopic gene astronauts. Colonies of genes, which, look how well I read this, eh? Reading it very well.
Yeah, much better than me.
Colonies of genes. I'm Barbara Frum. You're Knowlton Nash. You were knocked aside. You were obsolete by Barbara Frum. Okay. Colonies of genes, which once might have fled the primeval soup of the ocean and taken refuge in the geological structure of crystals, the chemistry of plants, then animals, and finally humans, but which now warp jump from the human body into the galaxy of virtual reality. This is a time of primordial genetic rocketry in which genes suddenly are accelerated into orbit around their previous liquid station, imploding human bodies. A new stellar history of TV genes, recombinant shopping, war meiosis, gene nostalgia, what molecular biologists call inversion, and advertising mimesis is at hand. Then there's a little... I'm back in the bar for a minute, and I say, you see the genes parasited in that novel by Tom Robbins, Even Cowgirls Get the Blues. It shows the amoeba riding evolution from the beginning to the end. Croker's got the genes just riding along. Finally, they realize this chemical body is a dead end, and they warp jump to another dimension and go right into the digital grids. It's the warp jump from the Android meme to the tech body. Okay, we're jumping ahead there. Back to the quote. And why shouldn't genes go cybernetic? They have always existed at the forefront of virtual reality. Mutants, replicators, cloning, viral genes. Perhaps we have already moved beyond the first stage of the exteriorization of the human sensorium, the externalization of the human nervous system, and are now entering the second and more decisive phase, which consists of actually flipping the body inside out, the exteriorization of human genetic history. In this case, technologies of communication would be the means by which the genes escape their long evolutionary imprisonment in the body and inscribe themselves in the labyrinthian electronic highways of recombinant culture. The primal gene, therefore, finally prepared to abandon its evolutionary home in bodily chemistry to fulfill its destiny by going virtual. What a fucking quote. McLuhan would never write like that.
He might have liked to.
Yeah, he might have been impressed with it.
Yeah.
Here's a side thing. Guess who's hanging around me and Ion all the time now? Mary Louise Croker, Arthur's wife, who apparently wrote a lot of this stuff. Mary Louise likes what we're doing. She's hanging around. She, you know, the late. She died 4 days apart from Eric McLuhan. They died together, basically. So there's a lot of Mary Louise in this stuff, because Arthur said that he would talk to Mary Louise and have these dialogues and then get all inspired and quickly write it down, whatever crazy stuff they were saying. So do you want to unpack the quote? What does it prompt you to say?
Well, one of the things it prompts me to say is that I think we're getting near the end here. Because that quote is so impressive and so interesting, maybe what we want to do is leave it for the next
time. Yeah, see where we go.
Yeah.
Yeah, how do I recover from this quote? What concepts do I do with this percept? Okay, so that's good. Let's carry on. As we move into the more extreme case of the present cloned ESP environment and the tech body, perhaps spinning its wake will stay the course as the non-now, there's no now anymore, echoes Frank Zappa's concept of xenocrony, which I'll have to explain. Now, I was in England in 2008, when Mrs. McLuhan died. I was meeting with this intelligence agent, Chris Story, the day she died. The guy that I met there knew all these poets in London, so I met with these poets. And then we were talking in the cafe on the sidewalk, and someone said something about the present. The present is all there is. And I said, there's not even a present anymore. And the girl looked at me shocked, and she quickly phoned her boyfriend and said, hey, there's no more present.
Yeah.
She put it back into the community immediately. So that's what I mean by the non-now.
Right. But isn't that what I keep saying against the chronological?
Yeah. Okay, as we move into the more extreme case of the present cloned ESP environment, which is technologies intimately extending themselves, and they've got the ESP among it themselves, and in the case of the present cloned ESP environment and the tech body, perhaps Finney's wake will stay the course as the non-now echoes Frank Zappa's concept of xenocrony. Do I explain that here? What's xenocrony? I say, okay, so I have footnote 64. What's that 64 after?
That's for the footnote at the bottom of the page. It's a link to the Wikipedia entry for xenocrony. I'll just say that xenos in Greek means stranger.
Yeah, xeno, X-E-N-O means stranger. That's right. So I hadn't noticed these numbers. Would this have been going on all along, I guess? I don't remember seeing any numbered quotes. I'm just going to scan back.
It's not a numbered quote. It's a footnote.
Yeah, I forgot to notice the footnotes.
Uh-huh.
Okay, so 60, well. Okay, so let's go to 64. Let's see if this works. I put in 64. It'll go immediately there. 1964. A lot of 64s to get 61, 2, 164. Okay, all right. So xenocrony. Do I need to talk about it for a minute?
Up to you.
All right. Let's see what the Wikipedia says. Okay. Xenocrony is a studio-based musical technique developed at an unknown date by Zappa, as possibly as early as the early 60s, and Zappa used it on several albums. Xenocrony is executed by extracting a guitar solo or other musical part from its original context and placing it into a completely different song to create an unexpected but pleasing effect. He said that this was the only way to achieve some rhythms. So he would collage things, you know, a drum solo from one concert with something, guitar solo from another concert, and hope that they kind of didn't jibe. He wanted to create contrast, which is tactility. One of the definitions of tactility is contrast. So he would always be surprised often that they would sync up or be pleasant. They would kind of get along. So I took that experience, that idea, and when I started noticing myself being reflected in the media, or mainly other people seeing it, I was not identifying with the ESP, cloned ESP. So the Android meme would constantly try to say, oh, no, Bob, you're in here. They were trying to say that I was involved, and I was trying to get not be involved, to be detached from it in some way. And so the Android meme would anthropomorphize me and say, look, you're in this movie. That's you. So what I was trying to avoid, the ESP, the merger, the fusion, the making, that was natural to me. And I kept being undermined. See, so what Zappa was doing with his studio and making a musical composition for the ear, he was trying to avoid pleasantness. Well, I was trying to avoid, in my living and interacting with the Android meme as a consumer producer, I was avoiding identifying with markers that would make me think I'm in there. In other words, I was trying to avoid the AP. So in the Tiny Note chart, the AP, one of the meanings is everybody through the bodies and the extensions are looking for themselves, trying to find themselves. That's the identity crisis. And so it's so weird, so much weird environment that they're looking for themselves in that you call it a projection, anthropomorphic physical. So I'm avoiding the AP as much as possible. So Xenocrony applied to music, but I applied it to global environments for myself. All right?
You okay? Yeah, but, well, it's not, I would be far from agreeing. I would say that...
yeah, we don't know what we're saying yet. We don't have to worry about agreement yet.
Okay. So the heart of Xenocrony is that the pieces already exist. And what's new is the juxtaposition.
Yeah.
Right? So there is no such thing. In this sense, there's no such thing as removal from the AP, because all there is pieces of the AP. What's different is how they're put together.
Yep. No, that's the problem I've got, if it's a problem.
No, it's the human condition.
Right. And I'm advocating a new kind of human. Not post-human. Yeah. I like to say para-human.
Yeah, yeah. Para is much better than post.
Yeah. So perhaps Finnegan's Wake will stay the course as the non-now echoes Frank Zappa's concept of Xenocrony. The early 21st century can be perceived as the digital/mobile phase of voluntary ESP. Yes, the analog phase merged people, fused them with the discarnate electric space. So that's cloned ESP. That's merging with the ESP. Then the ESP got cloned by technologies. they were extending. Now, I say the human is not extended anymore. Well, maybe the ESP part is being extended. What's that? We don't even know what it is. So it's a nebulous extension. But the atomization of digital media, what Thiel called co-anesthesia, which puts you in the driver's seat more and more, Web 2.0, social media puts you in the driver's seat, you're being removed from the cloned ESP merger. You're being removed from the one, and you're engaging in quadrophenia, different moods. So you blog either schizophrenia, hysteria, panic, ecstasy, or paranoia. That's what the blogs are. They're hoiking up these old human emotions in extremis as part of the gift of social media, giving you voluntary ESP. You don't have to engage with the oneness all the time. That's 1984 in a way. We've moved past that. So there's incredible new free spirit going on technologically. Free spirit to be stupid or to be a troll or to be a problem, to project a problem. That's what voluntary ESP is. So the early 21st century can be perceived as a digital mobile phase of voluntary ESP, a celebration of pinhead consciousness slash intelligence rather than simply discarnate connected tactile intelligence. I heard someone say they felt that most people in the social media environment at best have pinhead, the consciousness of a pinhead. And you don't need much. So much is done for you in the first world anyways. In this complex culture of tactility in extremis, see Frank Zappa's musical concepts. You have to read some Zappa, his speculation, his metaphysics. In this complex culture of tactility in extremis, we've witnessed the phrase artificial slash virtual intelligence lose its charisma. Quite a mysterious and devastating implication that nobody was expecting from the global theater. The greatest disservice that was foreseen was the evocation of desperation and urgency in national, tribal, and personal identity quests that created a more violent mood in the 70s and 80s. That was the greatest disservice that was foreseen, was the evocation of desperation and urgency. So people foresaw that. Then you replay the title of the McLuhan article in 68, Mind Your Media Men or You'll Catch a Cold Environment. So he's projecting more and more panic, hysteria, schizophrenia, and paranoia and ecstasy. So then I say, in the back of the bar, to have a social identity, you have to have violence. You are a fascist. You impose it on society. I'm taking the cliche idea that power is aggressive. You maintain your socially aggressive power if you want to have an identity. Establishing an identity is an act of violence. Becoming literate is a violent act. McLuhan, in one of his books, From Cliche to Archetype, quotes people fearing the literate back in the 1400s. Then I quote, Joseph Frank discusses Dostoevsky's The House of the Dead in terms which give stark, iconic force to the division between the literate and the illiterate classes in a feudal society. To the peasant, the literate man is armored. He calls them iron beaks. You gentry, iron beaks, you devoured us. That's when Visual Space took over, Gutenberg Galaxy. So then I quote McLuhan in Take Today, page 261, the maintenance of social power is in fact a manifestation of social identity. So I'm saying the AP is the weird version of identity that people are reaching for. And it's violent, and it has what are considered negative qualities, schizophrenia and that, but they are not seen as negative. They have a useful purpose for the user to be used. They're used by those attitudes, those mind states or emotions. So nothing but violence. So then I quote, who's this? This is another Croker quote.
No, it's McLuhan from the New York Times.
Oh, the famous one, New York Times. Right. This is a new quote. Or he's trying to show something. Okay, he says, one of the peculiarities of the new electronic world is to be seen here. For the very immediacy with which people interrelate at electric speeds also has the effect of reducing their private and individual identities to a very low profile. If everybody is a nobody at a ball game, the simultaneous presence of everybody to everybody at electric speed makes everybody a mass man. One of the effects of this simultaneity in dimming down private identity is the weakening of personal ethics and moral constraint in the private sectors of daily life. And then more and more talk about morals, rearview mirror, right? When no one's actually living morally anymore in the terms that that morality used to mean. Concurrently, however, with the loss of moral standards in these private sectors, there is a corresponding new demand for high standards of conduct and integrity in the public sector. This reversal of values has suddenly elevated politics to the utopian level by virtue of the rigorous and unremitting public inspection resulting from electric media, the global surveillance. This reversal has provided public and political life. This reversal has provided public and political life with a cast of representatives left over from the old order. That is, the figures in the political drama are still men of private goals and ambitions, recruited from the individualist age when politics seemed to most people to be a dirty game to be played by individuals with private ambitions. To many people, President Nixon may well appear as a leftover from that older political era when private ethics were expected to be high, but public behavior was permissibly much lower than it can ever be again. Public behavior cannot be casual. There's your woke. The new political pattern demands idealism, not only of profession, but behavior in public figures. But this demand is made by people who are quite permissive in their private ethics. A new kind of hypocrisy has been born among those who have grown up with the new media. They now demand of public figures a level of moral dedication which they feel no need to exemplify in the private sector of their own lives. New York Times, May 10th, 1974. So then academic Bob comes in and says, as the android meme provided cover for itself by allowing humans to perceive more and more that the android meme looked and acted like them, that's projecting AP, while at the same time it appeared to slowly disappear, the shrinking android meme evoked a renewed sense of anthropomorphic power in humans' chemical bodies. What's that mean? The shrinking android evoked a renewed sense of anthropomorphic power. Okay. Chemical brains, chemical body brains were projecting. Beginning with the mood of having survived Y2K and 9-1-1, in brackets overcoming the fear of the landscape of chip technology, the chemical body sought out nano communities online and in person and righteously announced a new confidence in their particular favored physical bias of form. That's AP, you know, your bias of projection of an anthropomorphic physical. Bias of physical bias of form. This was misidentified as the culture wars. Bob's back in the bar. He says, while the chemical body sought out nano communities, that's the texting, and righteously announced a new confidence in their particular favorite, it started announcing that they were transgender, and that was better than a heterosexual. New confidence in their particular favorite physical bias of form. Form is becoming, you know, shapeable. It was body wars. It was over what to do, what kind of shape to put the chemical body in. So when you weren't being shaped anymore, then everybody got involved with shaping themselves. You get that? Rearview mirror. Yeah. Old environment. And the aping is mixed in there, too. So then in comes a quote by Frank Zingroni. In his book, The Media Simplex, 2001, yeah. Subtitle, At the Edge of Meaning in the Age of Chaos. So what is Frank saying?
Bob, let me point out that we're not going to be able to get to the end of this chapter.
Well, that's all right. That means the war won't end. Yeah, we're going to finish this before anybody's going to have any conclusion over there in the Middle East. So, we've gone for 2.5 hours, right? pretty close to that.
Well, no. I think we started fairly close to 3 this time, so we've gone over 3 hours for sure.
Really? I thought, yeah. No, we started at 1 my time, and it's only 3:30. So we've only done 2.5 hours maximum. Because I remember it was 1:07, and we hadn't started yet, but we started right after that. So let me read this quote, and then we'll end with that for now, okay?
All right.
Because this is interesting what he says. He's wrestling with what I call the AP in his post-McLuhan way. His first chapter in the Media Symbolax is about the bias of McLuhan. McLuhan is so out of date that Frank begins by saying, well, McLuhan was biased this way, even though he's giving great tribute to McLuhan, but he says, nah, he's not going to be useful for what I'm seeing. Now, he didn't know his Lewis and McLuhan enough to see that, well, maybe McLuhan did see what he thinks he's seeing. Okay, politics and economics have always operated in secrecy. In information circles, media gatekeepers are the functionaries of the new Gnostics. Cyberspace bandits, information high priests, chaos investors, hacker terrorists, bank presidents, and IMF globalists, drug and biotech researchers, communication moguls, and sundry other infocrats across the data desert of the internet in one-person caravans. There's your atomization. One-person caravans, that's the everybody having the co-anesthetic role of the god at the center of their media sphere. They are the god. There is something fundamentally mysterious about the operations of electric process. That's his term for the new media environment, electric process. Every square centimeter of Earth has become a holographic point containing all of the transmissions over the face of the globe. The elimination of time and space in human interchange is a big enough revolution to completely change all social values. Virtualized, bodiless people can make no real society. The discarnate realities of electric process and their great economic power may be the problem, not the solution to our futures. Now, do I say much? Let me get to Cavell. So I'm just going to say my bar statement. Every square centimeter of Earth has become a holographic point, I quote from Zingroni. There's your hologram. Yes, now, we keep typing, but eventually we're going to run out of it, and that's where we got to. To show how silly things were, you make this statement that, quote, the economy is run by typing. That's how fragile the virtual economy was. But it was very strong in the sense it orbited around the chemical body economy. It sucked all the energy out of it. So, bit of a paranoia, schizophrenia, hysteria, panic, and ecstasy in what I'm saying here. Okay?
Yeah, you're playing with the whole concept of the AP.
Yeah, I'm playing with the guys trying to come past McLuhan. And they're verbose paragraphs.
Right. And nowadays, I'll bet nobody at all reads Zingroni.
That's right. I checked
lots of people are reading Lewis and McLuhan.
That's right. And I after I read the Media Simplex a month or so ago, I looked it up on Amazon. It's down there, you know, a 1 million, almost like 2 million, its position. It's number 2 million popular book, right? And it has no reviews, no buyers, nothing. Now, Zingroni knew that he was screwed. I think I told you. He tried to get it reviewed in Globe and Mail, and it got fucked up, and he got very mad. So he forced Don Thiel to write a review somewheres. I think it's in the Communication Journal, but the book never was the bomb that that Frank was hoping it would be. So when I read it finally, 22 years after it came out, I was impressed with it. He was getting towards what I was looking at, the AP. He was trying to get to it. So sorry, Frank. I wasn't around to acknowledge that, but you'll be in the famous essay, the famous new book, the last book of all time, my book. Wrapping it up, and the review of it, which we're doing, has to be done before any conclusion in the Mideast. So we're getting close. what happens if you got, we're on page 166. What do I do? Now, I quote more Zingroni. Yep, I cram a lot of stuff in there. So where are, well, you have to think about this. You don't know how much you want to go over or whether you want me to keep going, right?
Well, I just, I have things that I have to do with the dog. And
no, I don't mean that. I mean, when we get together again, will you want to go over what I've read or will you want me to read some more?
Well, I think the quotation from Croker is pretty interesting, so we could sort of start there, and
okay.
We could then skip, if you want to the end of the Zingroni quote and go on to the Take Today stuff, which starts next.
All right, so we're going to... The Croker quote starts on page 162, I think.
Yes, it does.
Yeah, there it is. So we will start at the bottom of 162. So you and your dog are free to go. class is over. what did Lewis end with? Teacher and taught are both duped, right?
That's right.
Okay, I'll go look that up in my copy of The Art of Being Ruled, page 111.
Yeah.
Okay.
Important,
all right.
Important page.
Beg your pardon?
Important page.
Yep. Okay. Congratulations. You're still here. Everything's disappeared, except Cameron. So we're doing well. All right. Thanks a lot, Cameron.
Good,
talk to
Bob.
You soon.
Keep the world going, okay?
Yeah, I will. We're going to finish this before any stopping happens.
Excellent.
Very good. Okay, talk to you later.
Take care.
Ciao. Bye.